But now I'm going to hand over to our speaker, who is Vinil Kumar, and he's a member of our branch in Sydney. He has many claims to fame, but one of them in particular is that in 2014 he got kicked off the set of Q&A for leading and being part of a rowdy protest against the then Education Minister scumbag Christopher Pyne. So please make him very welcome.
Now, as I said last night, there are productive ways of responding and expressing those frustrations, and there are destructive ways of responding. Burning buildings, torching cars, destroying property, putting people at risk, that's destructive, and there's no excuse for it. Those are criminal acts. And people should be prosecuted if they engage in criminal acts. But what we also saw, although it didn't get as much attention in the media, was people gathering in overwhelmingly peaceful protests here in Chicago and New York, in Los Angeles, other cities. We've seen young people who are organizing and people beginning to have real conversations about how do we change the situation so that there's more trust between law enforcement and some of these communities. So my message to those people who are constructively moving forward, trying to organize, mobilize, and ask hard, important questions about how we improve the situation, I want all those folks to know that their president is going to work with them. And a lot of folks, I believe, in law enforcement, and a lot of folks in city halls and governor's offices across the country want to work with you as well. The bottom line is nothing of significance, nothing of benefit results from destructive acts. So don't take the short-term easy route and just engage in destructive behavior. Take the long-term hard but lasting route of working with me and governors, officials, to bring about some real change. And to those who think that what happened in Ferguson is an excuse for violence, I do not have any sympathy for that. I have no sympathy at all for destroying your own communities.
Well, for those who would have placed their hopes in America's first black president, the 8 years that followed would have come as a bit of a rude shock. Now, most would have imagined that the first black president would have at least condemned the murder of an African-American teenager, called for justice, and at least pushed for some form of symbolic reform to the racist criminal justice system. Yet, I think it's clear that Obama shed more tears for shop windows, torched cars, and destroyed property in this speech than he did for Michael Brown. The script from which he read was one that was well worn by thousands of black elected officials and establishment figures that preceded him, and one that I have no doubt that we will see again. And this script goes like this. Anger is unproductive. Put your faith in the system and those who work within it. Yet I think, with more black faces in high places than ever before, and the situation for African Americans continuing to get worse, the validity of this strategy has been brought into question, and I think the need for an alternative strategy is urgently needed. The African American historian Manning Marable wrote, the primary tension in the history of black America is that between struggle and accommodation. And I think this video encapsulates that divide perfectly. Protests and riots versus the proper channels. Radical change versus gradual change. Black Lives Matter versus Obama and the black political establishment. Those who want to tear down the system versus those who want to maintain it. Now, while Obama denounced the uprising in Ferguson and scolded its participants, saying that nothing of benefit results from destructive acts, ironically, the history of the black struggle in America tells a dramatically different story. In fact, the doors to the halls of power for black politicians like Obama were burst open by the explosive black struggles of the 1960s, a centerpiece of which were the urban rebellions that swept the northern ghettos between 1964 and 1968. The first of these was in Harlem in July of 1964. This uprising was sparked by the murder of 15-year-old black teenager James Powell. James Powell was shot and killed by white police officers in front of his friends and a dozen witnesses. And unsurprisingly, the officer involved was eventually cleared of all charges. And again, that might sound familiar to you. Over the course of six nights, over 4,000 people took part in riots across the city, amongst its targets, the New York Police Department, and amongst its demands, the suspension of the officer responsible. The riots quickly spread to other cities, including Jersey City and Rochester. In the latter, the governor of New York State mobilized 1,500 National Guardsmen. Four people died, hundreds were injured, and 976 people were arrested. The following summer, the black ghetto of Watts in Los Angeles erupted in 6 days of rioting after a racist police officer pulled over and assaulted an African-American motorist. And again, that should ring a bell. 12,000 members of the National Guard were deployed to put down the riots, leaving 35 dead, 900 injured, and over 3,500 arrested. Riots followed in Chicago and San Diego, and in 1966, over two dozen other cities rebelled. But the most significant and large-scale rebellion of this period was in Detroit in 1967, in response to the police raid of an after-hours party. Governor George Romney and President Lyndon Johnson sent in the National Guard and the 82nd and 101st Airborne Divisions. The rebellion lasted 5 days, saw over 1,300 buildings destroyed, $500 million in damaged property, and 43 people killed, including a four-year-old girl whose room was blown up by a National Guard tank. Now, attempts are made at portraying this chapter in the black struggle as senseless and separated off from the more noble earlier struggles of the civil rights movement. However, these urban struggles very much had their roots in the civil rights movement and in the conditions faced by African Americans living in the ghettos of the North. Between the period of 1940 and 1970, some 5 million African Americans migrated from the South into the cities in the North, and by the end of this period, they comprised 80% of all African Americans nationally. A 1971 study of the 1967 riots by Robert Fogelson found that these riots typically involved between 10 to 20% of those living in the areas where they occurred, and they were generally representative of the broader local population in terms of occupations and living standards, and they generally enjoyed broader support for their actions amongst their communities. The actions of those involved also reflected a deeper political consciousness, with participants being inspired by and linking their struggles to those of blacks in the South. As the Southern struggles made advances, it gave confidence to those in the North for whom life was still a day-to-day struggle against structural racism. Because though the North claimed formal legal equality for blacks, discrimination and segregation still persisted in day-to-day life, even if it was not explicitly state-sanctioned. While not being turned down explicitly for being black, African Americans found themselves refused service in restaurants and found themselves struggling to find employment. Racist residential planning practices, real estate contracts that prevented sale of properties to black people, the Federal Housing Authority refusing to underwrite loans to integrated areas, infrastructure and roads planning, deficient public transport and school zoning. All of these things resulted in the creation of black ghettos where African Americans faced deteriorated standards of living. With limited choices in housing, landlords were able to inflate rent for black residents and force black families to live in cramped, overpriced, substandard housing. Landlords also adopted a grossly negligent attitude to the maintenance of their properties, and urban renewal projects would see a leap in rents, which forced some of the poorest black residents out of their homes and into other existing crowded ghettos. Restricted transport options also limited where people could shop, allowing shop owners to charge higher prices for inferior merchandise and for exorbitant terms to be imposed on those taking out credit. Children also faced educational disadvantages. Schools in predominantly black areas received less funding, with CORE reporting that black schools in Boston received 27% less funding per student than white schools in 1963. These schools were also staffed with less experienced teachers, and poverty meant other educational disadvantages, such as school students struggling to concentrate because they had skipped meals. Schools in all black districts found themselves lacking specialized support services, facing textbook shortages, and had fewer permanent teachers. African Americans were also facing limited economic opportunities, being relegated to the lowest paid, most unsafe and unsanitary jobs, and that's if they could find jobs at all. It was found that college graduates earned no more than whites did, who had left after the eighth grade of high school, according to one study. A high number were also forced to depend on welfare payments and faced humiliating discipline and intrusions into their personal lives, tearing families apart by, in some instances, forcing men to have to leave their families so that the women and the families could claim much-needed benefits to support their dependent children. Now, on all fronts, African Americans faced systematic disadvantage and deprivation that bred resentment and anger. They had much to rebel about, and the situation in the free North demanded that the black struggle had to address the economic inequalities that underpinned structural racism. Now, when Martin Luther King Jr. toured the area of Watts after the uprising there, a young man famously proclaimed to him, "We won." Now, when King queried this, the man responded, "Because we made them pay attention to us." And I think this exchange encapsulates so much of why these rebellions were important developments for the black struggle. What's immediately apparent from this exchange is the sheer confidence and feelings of collective power instilled on those who were involved, cutting against the crushing atomization and powerlessness of daily oppression. It marked a political deepening of the black struggle in a number of ways. It signaled that it was possible to gain concessions through mass action and militancy instead of purely moral appeals to power. It extended the struggle from the South and reinforced and refocused it on the North, where the concentration of the urban black population cultivated a social power that had previously remained unavailable to the movement. It broadened the struggle against racism beyond one centered purely around legal equality to one that encompassed questions of economic justice. For King, it led to the questioning of the poverty and economic inequalities that underpinned racism, leading him to question the nature of capitalism and to look towards the power of the labor movement and cross-racial working-class solidarity. These rebellions focused on the self-activity of the insurgent black masses, and the 1967 riot in Detroit would be a crucial factor in the establishment of the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, or DRUM, a revolutionary union of black auto workers in Detroit. Sorry. Now, the rebellions, however, represented a reckoning as well for the coalition of forces that had allied together in the earlier civil rights movement. While the moral and symbolic non-violent struggles for legal equality were palatable to more middle-class blacks and the political establishment, more radical struggles against structural disadvantage and poverty were not palatable. The problems highlighted by these riots were so much more difficult to address, requiring more than just simple legislation to outlaw formal discrimination. They required deeper structural changes. The forces who allied with Martin Luther King became indicative of which forces would support such a change. The Northern Democratic Party and liberal white opinion were hostile to the new focus, while he found support among some unions, including the United Auto Workers. Now, this new wave of urban struggle horrified the ruling class. The movement had taken an even more radical turn and threatened to pose an even greater challenge to the structure of American society. They responded in a number of ways. Now, first and most obviously was through brutal repression. Thousands of police and National Guard, as I've gone through, mobilized to intimidate and physically repress riots, protests, and even the most peaceful of demonstrations. Programs such as the FBI's notorious COINTELPRO mounted a concerted effort to disrupt the activities of radical black organizations such as the Black Panther Party and murdered prominent leaders like Fred Hampton. The FBI were later found to be targeting Martin Luther King, amongst other leaders, with the express purpose of preventing the rise of leaders who could unify and electrify the militant black struggle. Under the authorization of Attorney General Robert Kennedy and FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, they bugged his hotel room and even sent him letters attempting to convince him to commit suicide. These measures not only aimed to rob the movement of its most prominent and radical leaders, but to serve as a warning to those attracted to the more radical elements of the movement. However, the riots also made it clear that the movement could not be contained by repression alone. The granting of concessions were important victories achieved by the black struggle from below, but they also represented often desperate attempts by the ruling class to diffuse anger. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 and increased funding to some of the urban areas which rebelled aimed to ameliorate some of the conditions of deprivation and also to diffuse discontent. President Lyndon Johnson, on one hand, was forced to publicly acknowledge and pledge to address these underlying conditions, while on the other hand, began to blame blacks themselves for the breakdown of black families, and the breakdown of black families for conditions of poverty. Now, while these concessions gave those who struggled confidence in their own power, it was also used by the government to try and present itself as on the same side of the struggle and as an institution committed to addressing inequality in black America. Now, most significant for the ruling class was the opening up of a space for the integration of black politicians into the running of black communities, serving as an important buffer between an insurgent black population and the political establishment. The situation in the late 1960s lent itself to this development in a number of ways. White governments presiding over destitute black communities had become an obvious source of tension. greater calls for community control and the provision of services to combat decades of neglect span both moderate sections of the movement and organizations like the Black Panthers, for whom serving the community through charity had become a focus. The repression and murder of radical black figures began to discourage more radical forms of politics and present electoralism as a safer option. According to one black politician, the project of greater black participation in mainstream electoral politics was seen as a way to enter the political arena and wrest control for ourselves a share of the decision-making power by electing new black officials whose allegiance is the black people who elected them. Holding office was sold as a way to access greater resources and influence to advance the black cause. Now, it's important to recognize that those who led the charge into the electoral arena were not dupes of the white political establishment, but rather willing participants whose own politics led them down the path of mainstream bourgeois politics. Every political force seeking to change society has to deal with the question of social power. What is the method by which they will exercise power over society to reshape it according to their vision? Now, in this instance, what power could be mobilized to force the American state and ruling class to implement broad sweeping improvements to the conditions of poor and working class blacks? The only such force that existed and exists today is the working class. But those who recognized that social power were too small and too marginal to be able to organize it and to direct the movement towards it. This strategy also seemed all the less viable due to the weakness of American unions and the racist policies that were often adopted by their union officials. Thus, with no alternative avenues available to them, as mass action began to retreat, the answers most in the movement turned towards was to capture political power through the existing capitalist state, specifically through the vehicle of the Democratic Party. Those who took this turn either had not yet reached the conclusion that the system had to be overthrown, or believed it to be impossible and winning reforms through the government more pragmatic, but most who pursued this path had no intention of ever challenging American capitalism. The broader political establishment approved of this turn and promoted greater black control of black areas as a safeguard against urban upheaval. The growth of black businesses, the development of black entrepreneurs, and black capitalism more generally was promoted as alternative interpretations of black power by political figures as far up the food chain as Richard Nixon. There was an aggressive effort to cultivate a small but stable black middle class through increased government employment, support for black business owners, and improvements in pay and living conditions for professional and salaried blacks. In the space of four decades, African Americans earning over $75,000 would rise from 3.4% to 15.7%, and those earning over $100,000 from 1% to 9%. It was from this newly developing black middle class that thousands of black officials would arise, and it was to this layer that they oriented. The rise of the black middle class and the election of black officials throughout the country represented a new chapter in racism in the United States. Structural oppression and material disadvantage continued and in many respects intensified for the majority of African Americans. Yet for all intents and purposes, the ruling class could now present American society as one where discrimination against blacks was formally a thing of the past. Blacks were now supposedly free to participate in a society on an equal footing as whites, and institutions now became considered legally colorblind. The rise of a new black middle class became championed as proof that there were no structural barriers that prevented black advancement. In keeping with the ideology of the neoliberal period, individual success through hard work and working within the system became the new narrative that would replace collective struggle as the way in which African Americans could get ahead. However, the subtext of this narrative ultimately blamed black people for their own oppression. Author and activist Michelle Alexander describes this phenomenon in her book, The New Jim Crow. Highly visible examples of black success are critical to the maintenance of a racial caste in the era of colorblindness. Black success stories lend credence to the notion that anyone, no matter how poor or how black you may be, can make it to the top if only you try hard enough. These stories prove that race is no longer relevant. Whereas black success stories undermine the logic of Jim Crow, today they actually reinforce the system, which depends for its legitimacy on the widespread belief that all those who appear trapped at the bottom actually chose their fate. This new mantra of personal responsibility shifted the blame for oppression both away from the structures of the deeply racist society in which blacks lived, but also helped downplay the role of the black establishment in upholding the status quo. Now, claims that black elected officials' allegiance was to people who elected them does not match up to their record in office. Their allegiance has always been to business, and instead of using any state power under their command to improve the lives of working class and poor blacks, they have repressed the very people they have professed to serve. Carl Stokes became the first black mayor of a major American city in Cleveland in 1967, with the backing of the Democratic establishment and prominent civil rights organizations. He pledged to be the mayor for all people without favour or unfair special consideration, rich and poor, whites and Negroes, bankers and busboys. He notably promised white voters that he could keep the peace in black neighbourhoods and would not tolerate violence in the streets, and promised to be hospitable to businesses. Stokes gave businesses a significant role in urban renewal public-private partnerships worth millions of dollars and spent thousands upgrading police weaponry, and he even used fear of crime in black neighbourhoods to campaign for his re-election. In 1977, Atlanta Mayor Maynard Jackson turned on 900 striking black sanitation workers who had helped elect him 3 years prior. He demonised their white union president as a racist manipulator, refused to increase their wages, and sacked all of them, winning him the praise of big businesses, the media, and the local black middle class. In 1985, Philadelphia's black mayor, Wilson Good, ordered the police bombing of a black neighborhood in order to suppress a black counterculture group called MOVE. The bombing destroyed 62 working-class homes and killed 11 black people. And it's worth noting that that photo of Wilson Good is actually him posing for a publicity photo at the site of the bombing when it was being rebuilt afterwards. What a fucking hero. Now, while they had been elected on the promise of alleviating the conditions that fueled the riots of the 1960s, the 1980s Miami riots demonstrated the real way in which the black establishment would relate to urban rebellions. 3 days of rioting broke out after the acquittal of four police officers who had beat black veteran Arthur McDuffie to death and then attempted to cover it up by claiming he had been in a motorcycle accident. 18 people were killed, 1,000 were injured, and over $100 million of property was damaged. The black political establishment, instead of doing something to actually address the conditions and to address police violence, rushed to Miami to calm the black community and to redirect anger into electoral channels. Now, the root cause of this sordid record lies not in the individual failings of those elected, but in their choice to become managers of American capitalism, even if it was on a small scale. While they campaigned on improving services and conditions in their communities, this could not be done independently of the economic constraints of the system, nor by neglecting the political responsibility of maintaining law and order over their cities. Black officials took control of some of America's biggest cities in a tumultuous economic climate, characterized by closures of some massive manufacturing plants in the 1970s, throwing hundreds of thousands of predominantly black workers into unemployment. The era of neoliberalism meant gross neglect and broken promises to black communities on behalf of the Democratic Carter government and savage federal cuts made to social spending by the Reagan administration. The number of African-American families living in poverty increased by 2 million in Reagan's first year in office. Black officials, now in charge of cities characterized by dramatically rising inequality, were forced to manage them with dwindling funds and resources. Pragmatism finally revealed itself for the political poison that it was. Accepting the logic of responsible economic management of city budgets meant keeping businesses profitable through privatization at the expense of public infrastructure and social spending. It meant managing the effects of poverty, mainly crime, drug, and social discontent, by pouring funds into law enforcement and prisons and support for Reagan's racist war on drugs, which saw the mass incarceration of thousands of African Americans for minor drug offenses. Being electorally pragmatic meant adapting to the pressures of fiscal responsibility and even using race to shore up their own electoral base. But it also meant transcending or downplaying race to appeal to white voters in a deeply racist society, doing so in order to break through what became known as the glass ceiling of electoralism. The era marked a further shift to the right of black electoral politics. Now, during the 1990s, black elected officials either put up no resistance to or actively supported some of the most brutal anti-black policies of the Clinton administration. This included the Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act of 1994 that expanded the use of the death penalty and life sentences, put 100,000 more police on the streets, cut funding for inmate education, and included $10 billion in funding for the construction of private prisons. While some black politicians did not vote for these measures directly, they supported procedural motions that brought them to a vote and made comments on the issue which legitimized the racist debate. Most notably, former presidential candidate Jesse Jackson stated, "There is nothing more painful to me at this stage in my life than to walk down the street and hear footsteps and start thinking about robbery, than to look around and see someone white and feel relieved." In 1992, Los Angeles erupted in riot over the acquittal of four police officers responsible for the widely televised beating of black motorist Rodney King. LA's black mayor of 19 years, Tom Bradley, anticipating the decision, organized a town hall meeting of thousands of black residents at a local black church where he encouraged them to channel their anger into voting and supporting his appointment of LA's first black police chief. He told the crowd, We must not endanger the reforms we have achieved by resorting to mindless acts. We must not push back progress by striking back blindly. He also appeared on the Arsenio Hall show and had one direct message to black LA residents. Don't break the law or we will put you in jail. When his efforts failed to install calm, he ordered a curfew and requested the federal intervention of the California National Guard and the 7th and 1st Infantry Divisions of the U.S. Army. Over 6 days, thousands of black, Latino, Asian, and white rioters took part in looting and targeted the LAPD headquarters. 63 people were killed, over 2,000 were injured, and over 12,000 were arrested. Presidential frontrunner Bill Clinton called for tougher action on crime and preached personal responsibility to black residents. But for the first time since the 1970s, a mass black uprising had forced broader society to pay attention to the situation of African Americans. It was an important step in rebuilding the confidence of those oppressed in American society to fight back. But now, voices of condemnation from the black establishment were well-placed to denounce and belittle the frustrations of working-class blacks who face backlash on all fronts.
What does the looting, the televisions, the shoes, or whatever you're looting for, have to do with Rodney King? So why did you do it?
You have to understand what happened to why we did it.
Yeah,
the reason we did it was because we needed self-satisfaction. We had no satisfaction in what happened to Rodney King. 425 years of being unsatisfied, what am I to do? Hmm. What am I to do? I'm looking at the news and they're telling me my life is not worth a nickel. They're telling me that they can beat me. They can do whatever they want to me, whatever they feel like. Huh. And when I'm supposed to accept this and say, well, we'll just go vote and make it better. It hasn't been better. We've been voting for years, and it's not changing.
When after the stuff that you got, some of the things that you got, did you feel better after that?
Definitely. I feel better.
You felt better?
That was 22 years ago already. And we wanted to know, what happened to Larry? He's the young man who didn't hold back in that very heated audience. We tracked Larry down at his home in Long Beach, California.
Welcome to my home in Long Beach. This is my family. This is my wife, Yolanda. This is my son, Justin. My son, Jared. And Jarrell is right here. Well, we're headed to Florence and Normandy. Started.
It's been 20 years since the Oprah show, and I'm feeling pretty good about my life up to now. Now, looking back on it now, I could have been better, but at the time, I was, you know, young, and, you know, that's what I did. After appearing on the Oprah show, it was different for me. I didn't know the repercussions of that. I thought I was going to go back to my job. So, it's like, and he was like, no, you can't come back here. So that was different. They get fired.
I mean, had I known what I know now, I would have kept my mouth shut.
This stuff is brand new because all this was, oh, look, this stuff, they're just rebuilding this. From that long ago. 22 years ago, I had a different opinion. But as of today, I can tell you that looting and violence is wrong.
We're on the corner of Florence and Normandy. This is actually where the 92 riots began. It's the corner where they just went nuts after the verdict. And from here, they went on to destroy a whole lot of things in this city. Oprah coming down to Los Angeles 22 years ago made it different because she brought us all in there to talk. And a lot of people kept talking after that.
You're doing that running around blowing up stuff. What are you doing?
Shoot yourself in the foot. We need to organize. We need to get these people and channel that rage the right way. There should be as many people out there looting, should be in line voting on every election. We have to empower ourselves inside out. We cannot sit up there and ask for somebody to help.
Now, it's worth noting that when 18-year-old Michael Brown was shot dead by police officer Darren Wilson on the streets of Ferguson in August 2014, Oprah did not put together a segment calmly explaining to racist police officers why it's wrong to murder black teenagers and leave their bodies lying in the street. nor did she put together a segment on why militarized police should not show up with assault rifles and tanks to fire tear gas and rubber bullets at black people demanding that they not be killed in the streets. While the mainstream media implicitly justified Michael Brown's murder by showing footage of him allegedly robbing a convenience store, the public denunciations of protester violence by black establishment figures in the press reinforced the narrative that the problem here was not one of racism, poverty, and police brutality, but one of criminal behavior perpetrated by the black residents of Ferguson. And Reverend Al Sharpton disgracefully used his speech at Michael Brown's funeral to denounce black protesters.
Each other. I'll kill and shoot and run around gun-toting each other so that they're justified in trying to come at us because some of us act like the definition of blackness is how low you can go. Blackness has never been about being a gangster or a thug. Now we get to the 21st century. We get to where we got some positions of power. And you decide it ain't black no more to be successful. Now you want to be a nigga and call your woman a hoe. We got to clean up our community so we can clean up the United States of America.
Now, where once white politicians would have attracted scorn and denunciation for railing against the supposed criminality of protesting African Americans, today, the black middle class and black elite are able to get away with saying things and scolding black resistance in a way that no white politician ever could. Yet despite the conservative backlash against the protests, and precisely because the story of Michael Brown was all too familiar and would continue to echo in the stories of Trayvon Martin, Tamir Rice, Eric Garner, Sandra Bland, Philando Castile, and hundreds of others, precisely because of this, protests spread around the country and drew solidarity all across the world, including from protesters in Palestine. It fueled a movement around the United States that exposed the ongoing brutality and poverty faced by blacks in America. Solidarity also came from workers both locally and around the country. Five workers from a local Ferguson Chipotle, I'm sure that's how you pronounce it, fast food outlet, donated $1,000 worth of chips and burritos to protesters and marched alongside them. A group of Pizza Hut workers organized out-of-town donations and made contributions of their own. A group of UPS workers discovered that one of their clients was a company called Law Enforcement Targets. Now, this company provided the Ferguson Police Department with practice targets, specifically a urban street violence range featuring images of black men. Now, these workers decided that they would refuse to handle these deliveries in a campaign they dubbed Hands Up, Don't Ship. The protests and the solidarity they garnered were a defiant warning to the state and to the ruling class that they could not simply continue to destroy black lives without facing repercussion and a fierce fightback. An important victory of these protests was the return of black urban rebellions struck fear into the heart of the establishment who had for too long neglected and brutalized black communities. Several months later, that rage reached new heights when Freddie Gray was murdered by police in the back of a Baltimore police van. Protests began as details of his arrest and death became public, and riots erupted after police attacked high school students in the hours after Gray's funeral, and the students fought back. Now, thousands took part in the rebellion. Hundreds were arrested, including 49 children. The riots eventually resulted in charges being brought against the six police officers involved. But in July of 2016, three of the officers were acquitted, and eventually the charges against the remaining officers were dropped by Baltimore City's black state attorney, Marilyn Mosby. However, Mosby made sure that not everyone faced jail time. In the weeks prior to the acquittals, a number of black protesters were sentenced to years in jail. The harshest of these sentences was dished out to a man named Donta Betts, a 20-year-old black man who was photographed pouring lighter fluid on propane tanks in the street. He was sentenced to 15 years in jail. In the wake of the rioting, Obama once again called for calm, respect for the police, denounced the riots, and suggested that the absence of irresponsible black fathers was a factor in the violence. Oprah also echoed the focus on black parenting when she personally called and congratulated a woman who went violent for scolding her son for participating in the riots. But Obama was also forced to pay lip service towards the poverty and conditions within black communities in like Baltimore. But while some statements are a victory for the side of the protesters, these remarks can't be anything but hollow. Obama has overseen the exacerbation of poverty, unemployment, and homelessness in the United States following the GFC, while handing out trillions in corporate bailouts and billions in funding to the police and private prisons. Mere weeks before the protests in Ferguson, Obama cut $8.7 billion in food stamps, affecting 1 in 4 black households. Yet the betrayal of the black establishment in the case of Baltimore is not isolated to merely Obama. Unlike Ferguson, which is still largely a black city run by white officials, Baltimore was a city that had been run for years by black elected officials. In addition to the aforementioned state attorney who cleared Freddie Gray's uniformed killers, three of them were black. Gray's murder took place under the watch of Baltimore's 7th black police commissioner. The case brought against the police was brought by a black prosecutor and presided over by a black judge. The riots occurred alongside the appointment of the 2nd consecutive black attorney general and during the greatest presence of black members of Congress in American history. Baltimore's 2nd black mayor, Stephanie Rawlings Blake, described protesters as criminals and thugs, which Obama echoed a few days later. Now, when the black struggle took a turn towards electoralism in the 1960s, the era of black politicians holding office and the subsequent narrative of black individual success was sold as advancing the interests of blacks as a whole. Yet the past 50 years of the struggle against racism in the United States, and in particular, the history and mere existence of urban rebellions, have exposed this as a lie. There has been no uniting sense of black identity that has been a source of common interest for poor and working class blacks and the black establishment. Black America has always been class divided. Slavery had not been the fate of every black person who arrived in North America. The initial arrivals of Africans in the middle of the 17th century included a number of blacks who were either free or would eventually become so after a period of indentured servitude. When African slavery became widely established in the 18th century, affluent sections of the black population had already established themselves as entrepreneurs, artisans, and landowners. 5 years before the Civil War, there were $50 million worth of black enterprises, half of which were based in the slave South. The earliest conflict of interest between laboring blacks and those who relied on the labor of others is embodied in Anthony Johnson, who became the first black slave owner in America in the mid-1650s and would go on to become a successful owner of a tobacco plantation. The fundamental interests of blacks and non-blacks who have nothing to sell but their ability to work in order to survive has always been counterposed to those whose wealth depended on the exploitation of that labor and dividing the labor force against racial lines in order to secure their position. Nor do poorer working-class blacks have common interests with black politicians whose position requires them to manage the common interests of the ruling class through the state machinery, interests that include facilitating the profitability of businesses and protecting the position of the wealthy through strong repressive institutions like prisons and the police force. The black struggle has no allies in power. The racism that has been virulently promoted from the top of American society since slavery has served an important role for American capitalism, to obscure the common interests between laboring blacks and whites that could unite them against the ruling class. And the instance of Bacon's Rebellion in 1676 was that rebellion was just the kind of multiracial rebellion that horrified the establishment and gave them a real urgency to promote divisions between blacks and whites. Today, the working class is larger and potentially more powerful than it's ever been, turning the gears of every industry imaginable and includes people of every gender, religion, sexuality, and race. Our common struggle creates the basis for divisions to be broken down, and our ability to shut down the wheels of production is where our strength lies. This is the power to ameliorate the conditions and destroy the structures that underpin black oppression and to end the system that perpetuates it. Thus, black liberation is tied up with the liberation of the working class as a whole, and the black elite, who have made their peace with capitalism, will fight alongside their non-black allies in the ruling class in order to defend it. They will defend it with their economic power, through the structures of the state, and through the lies that distort the nature of our society and the divisions within it. The struggle against black oppression requires a rebellion against the false promises that we are all fed, that if we work hard, that we'll get ahead, that collective action is no longer necessary, that the system works for us, that meaningful change can be won by working within it, and that those in power are our allies. The only power that can be brought to bear on the system that oppresses us all is our collective might. It is our collective might in the streets and in our workplaces, where we can shut down the system, take control of it ourselves, and bring to birth a new world from the ashes of the old. To wield such a power requires unity and requires confidence in our collective strength, something that can only be built through the process of struggle, whether they be through protests, through occupations, strikes, and, of course, riots. The revolution that overthrows capitalism, the ultimate urban rebellion, is the only thing that can fulfill the promise not only of black liberation, but of total human liberation.